This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, we feature a panel discussion on the gender wage gap in Utah, the causes that drive it, its consequences for women and the economy, and what policies effectively address the discrepancy. The gender wage or pay gap refers to the difference in income between men and women across the economy, and specifically for those doing the same work. In a study by the American Association of University Women, Utah and Louisiana had the largest wage gaps in the nation, according to census data from 2016. In both states, U.S. women who worked full-time and year-round on average earned only 70 cents on the dollar compared with men, with the higher national average resting at 80 cents. This large gender wage gap contributed once again to Utah receiving WalletHub's worst ranking in terms of women's equality for the third year in a row. The criteria WalletHub used was based on evaluations of the state's workplace environment, education, health, and political empowerment for women. Utah's score was only a third of the top-ranked state, Hawaii, at 75.13 and 25.74, respectively. But to even rise above last place and surpass Idaho, ranked 49th, Utah would have to make significant gains over the next year. Speaking on how Utah could achieve this are Gunsley Barrick, professor in the Economics Department and Asian Studies Program at the University of Utah. Nilofer Chatai, co-director and professor of the University of Utah Economics Department. Claudia Geist, associate professor in the Gender Studies and Sociology Departments at the U. And Senator Luz Escamilla of the Utah State Legislature. Moderating the discussion is Juliet Tenner, director of Economic and Public Policy Research at the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute. This forum was co-sponsored by the Women's Resource Center and the Women's Enrollment Initiative. This forum was recorded on March 25th, 2019. Here is your moderator, Juliet Tennert.
All right, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. I am just thrilled to have the opportunity to moderate this discussion, and I think if the discussion in this room is any bit as interesting in the little bit of time that we had in the conference room before, we're in for a real treat this afternoon. In today's panel, we want to start to address some of the important questions around the gender wage gap, starting with what is the gap? Just understanding some data around the gap. Why? Why do we have a gap? And what are the consequences of this gap? And then how? How do we start to address this challenge? And so my panelists are incredibly distinguished. I think we'll keep this as conversational as possible, but they all come with unique perspectives and areas of expertise. And so I'm just going to turn it over to them, and then we'll kind of guide the discussion through. But Professor Barrick, could you start by just laying out a landscape of what it is we're actually talking about?
Okay.
Excellent.
I will start with some a statistical portrait and sort of a comparison of Utah to United States nationally. And as many of you are aware, we are at the bottom of the pile in terms of the states, in terms of the gender wage gap across the United States. The latest figures show that full-time, year-round employed women annually earn 70 cents on the dollar that men earn in Utah, whereas nationally, that's 80 cents. And so there is a gap of 30 cents, a gender wage gap of 30 cents in Utah and 20 cents nationally. So clearly, this sort of directs us to what is differentiating Utah from the rest of the country. But I want to, at the beginning, add a caveat here. We're looking at a really relatively small group of people here, full-time, year-round workers. And in fact, when we take a sort of include the all workers, part-time, part-year workers, and sort of take a long time span, such as like a 15-year period of time, then we see actually the gender wage gap is far greater because not everybody, especially not all women, work full-time, year-round persistently. In fact, for this 15-year period, studies show that 29% of women did so and 59% of men did so. So then we get a more realistic picture of how family care, combining, balancing family care and paid work impacts the gender wage gap. And so that's the caveat I want to start out with. But I want to turn to again, looking at some of the sources as we see in the statistics of Utah's wage gap versus the U.S. And here we see very clearly, just really cursory look at the statistics, we see that Utah women tend to be more crowded into fewer occupations than nationally, and those are clerical, sales, and teaching. And then the wage gaps in these occupations are greater than they are nationally. So the combination obviously feeds into our wider wage gap than nationally. So to give an example, teachers in our state, full-time year-round working teachers, not including part-time teachers, basically earn the median income is 71% of what men earn. This is women versus men in Utah. Nationally, it's 81%. So there's already a 10 percentage gap for our teachers compared to the nation as a whole. On the other side, the top occupation, top employer of men in our state, management, has a 69% earnings ratio in Utah versus 75% nationally. So at the top of the earnings scale, there is a wider gap. In the most crowded occupation, one of the most crowded occupations for women, there's a wider gap. So you can see how all of this feeds into our making our gap wider. But it doesn't end there. I want to mention two other things. So occupational crowding is one. And then there's the education gap. Our state, women in our state, are unfortunately less likely to have bachelor's degrees or higher, and compared to nationally, and compared to men. And nationally, there's no gender gap in this regard. So that's another factor that feeds into our gender wage gap. And thirdly, and this is sort of determined on the basis of statistical studies that factor in various plausible explanatory factors for our gender wage gap. These studies show that there is something that is unexplained in terms of our gender wage gap by occupational crowding or education or other sort of plausible factors. And in fact, the labor market in Utah rewards men and women differently. And men tend to command a wage premium in the Utah labor market compared to women. So those three factors, which disparate treatment, I guess, is the last one we could refer to, occupational crowding and educational shortfalls are the factors that then we want to explain why is it that we see these differences in Utah versus nationally. And of course, those three factors will also feed into our policy discussions. In other words, we need to take a multi-pronged approach to address each of these problems in our state. So I think I'll stop there.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think that's it provides us with a nice kind of lay of the land, what it is we're talking about. I appreciate that. Professor Chadde, could you kind of chime in on some of your research? I know that you're looking at wage gaps across the United States. I know that you have some great international perspective. Some more on the why.
Yes, there is a little bit of a difference between the state of Utah and the rest of the country, but there is no country in the world that has achieved equality. Mm-hmm. And actually, some of the countries that are, really trying hardest, countries like Iceland or Scandinavian countries, they have some of the lowest gaps, and they're also the countries that have been trying very hard and are coming up with lots of policies. Now, in terms of my experience internationally, I'd like to say that I've been an academic for many years, but I've also worked as an economic advisor on poverty reduction and social development for a UN agency called United Nations Development Programme, UNDP. I've also recently had a stint working as, again, economic advisor for another UN agency called UN Women. So some of the things that I'm going to say about the causes and the why closing the gender gap matters, and then maybe later on, you know, what we can do, is based on not only academic research, but also some of the experiences in the practical world of policymaking and developing policies. I think in terms of the causes, and I think Günseli also, there's going to be some overlap, obviously, between what we are all saying. But the principal cause of gender wage gaps, gender earnings gaps, and there are many, many different ways to measure these gaps. But the principal distinction is generally between the unadjusted wage gap, and then there's a adjusted wage gaps that we calculate, and then we try to explain what the remaining differences are when you control for things like a level of education or other kinds of parameters that might contribute to the productivity of males and females in any one particular location, country, and setting. So we are talking now mostly about the unadjusted wage gaps, but it is important to bear these in mind, these differences in mind. It is also important to really think about why this matters. First of all, it's an issue of justice. Obviously, that's obvious, and one could say that to the extent that according to the Constitution of the United States, the Constitution of many countries, and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, we are all supposed to be treated equally under the law. And of course, we all know that in reality and in economic life, we are not. Gender is one of those axes of inequality, of course, class, but gender, as well as racial and ethnic differentiation. So we have to bear those in mind, and maybe bring the practices in line with what constitutions and universal declarations on human rights say. But also, there are other reasons why these gaps matter in economic life in terms of the growth rates that economies can achieve, in terms of the incidence of poverty, because gender gaps contribute to higher incidence of poverty. And when I say poverty, it's just the simplest measure of it is the percentage of people who live below the poverty line with respect to a national poverty line. And gender gaps in wages and earnings and the unpaid care work burden that women undertake at a higher rate compared to men is a principal reason for the kind of incidence of poverty that generally in many countries seems to be higher. Gender gaps in wages also contribute to poverty of women, elderly women in old age. And in the state of Utah, we have a higher incidence of poverty for elderly women, but also in many other countries and in other states as well. And the reason for this is that gender gaps are the basis of the bias in social security systems or social insurance systems, that's the general name given to them, and in social protection systems. Why is that? Because many social insurance system in the world are based on how much you earn, what you get paid in your as a pension depends on how much you earn and how long you work. But because women tend to give a break, especially in their childbearing years, that's called labor attachment to labor market. So it's supposedly women have a lower attachment to labor market. But the reason for that is, of course, having children, and somebody has to have children. So unless people have a better solution to that, it's going to be women who will be having the children. And then we have to think about how we can make this not a cost on women and mothers who have children, but how we actually share that economic burden, so to speak, collectively in society itself. So, but going back to my social protection or social security systems, the gender gap shows up directly as a disadvantage in your pension if you're a woman, and also because of the years that have been, and there are ways to fix that. Other countries do that. I might be able to come back to that when we're talking about the kinds of policies that we can undertake. But this contributes to poverty or higher incidence of poverty among elderly women compared to men. What does this mean from a macroeconomic point of view? What this means is that to the extent that we have a system, to the extent that we have decided as a society that we are going to give social assistance to people, to folks who have insufficient incomes below the poverty line, and also to people who have disabilities, who cannot be, you know, fully employed and so on, we have to close the gaps, and of course we don't. I mean, even though we make an effort, we don't necessarily close the gaps, but what that means is that we actually spend what our public revenues, taxes, partly on closing these gaps. If we didn't have the wage gap over the working life, gender wage gap, but also this is true of racial wage gap, ladies and gentlemen, then we would actually not be spending those taxes, and we could be spending the taxes to actually put in systems, for example, that provide for a social infrastructure of care. I don't know how much time I have, but I'd like to say a couple more things.
Go for it, and then
at the rate, so I'm also involved with the research with three PhD students, and I see some of them in the room. Kevin. Ta-da. And Han, there is Han, and there is another partner in crime that we have, Sammy from the business school, and she's not here, but we are working on a study that actually uses panel data going back decades to figure out the explanations for gender gaps at the state level in the states of the United States, and what are the things that contribute to explaining these gender gaps across countries. I will come back to some of the issues because I don't want to take too much time, but there are also issues that have to do with policy, with bargaining systems. In general, we know from data from around the world and research from around the world, collective bargaining systems are to the advantage of women. They help close wage gaps. Collective bargaining systems actually also help increase minimum wages. This is good for women because women are at the bottom of wage hierarchies. And there are, of course, another very important thing is the provisioning of social infrastructure of care, not only for children in terms of childcare and early child education facilities that are of a good quality, but also care for the elderly, because again, it's disproportionately women who take care of the elderly folks in their family, and also care facilities for people with disabilities, again, because this is something that women shoulder disproportionately, and there are lots of other factors, but I'm going to...
Excellent. Thank you.
That's Niloufer Chatai, co-director and professor of the University of Utah's Economics Department. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Today we are airing a panel discussion on the gender wage gap in Utah. Here again is moderator Juliet Tennert.
Maybe. Professor Geist, I hope that you, so from an economist's perspective, we're looking at kind of some of the reasons, explaining away why some of the gap exists, occupational selection, this labor attachment. Can you help us understand from a sociologist's viewpoint, help us to kind of challenge those things as maybe, okay, they explain part of the gap, but maybe there's more to it than just explaining it away.
Well, thank you very much. So I will get to that in just one second. I want to follow up with some of the racial inequities. Excellent. And I don't have data just for the state of Utah. So the data that we have for the United States, you know, again, it may be a little bit more optimistic, and I only have one hand for my air quotes here, as we see that the gaps, gender gaps, is larger in Utah overall. But, you know, overall, for full-time, full-year workers, Latinas make 53% compared to white men. And African-American women make 61% of what white men make. Asian women, you know, the way data are collected, this is just one group. We know that there is great variation within this group, are at 85%. But for example, Native Hawaiian Pacific Islanders are at 62%, and Alaskan Native women are at 58%. So one of the things is, like, these numbers are large. So if you get outraged, as you should, I think, at sort of the size of the gender wage gap, you know, it's even worse when we look at women of color. And so this is one of the things, it's like, don't go in it just like worrying about the white women, because like where it really, really matters is especially for women of color who really are struggling financially. And these are just the number for the full-time, full-year workers. And so you can just imagine what things are. What the prompt I was given is also to challenge some of the narrative of when we try to understand what's going on. Because one solution is to change behaviors, and that's important. I mean, we have the Women's Enrollment Initiative, which like I love and favor, is because, yeah, like one solution to get better earnings is to have like more education and encourage people to like do the things that we know are associated with higher earnings. But it's not enough to just tell people like get that engineering degree, finish college more quickly, do it all. It's that there are bigger structural issues. And part of that is, you know, the way we think about responsibilities in the domestic division of labor, how we have conceptualized, especially care work, broadly defined for children, but also for the elderly, as women's responsibility. And it essentially may leave women at this catch-22, where either you reject what is seen as like a responsibility and like go out and become, you know, a go-getter who may still experience some discrimination with that like unexplained gap, but then also maybe get the social pushback of not being a good mother, not being a good enough daughter or daughter-in-law or granddaughter. And so the solutions, like when we see the components of the gaps, to say, oh, well, people should just like choose different majors. They shouldn't become teachers. They shouldn't work in sales. You know, that is not the whole story. I mean, part of it is really the stories we tell ourselves, like, what do women do, or how do women behave? And unfortunately, it's more complicated than just saying, like, get a college degree, like, become a full-time, year-round worker, and things will be fine-ish. You know, it's a reflection of how we encourage people to do different things. These things are rewarded differently. And even if people reject and are trailblazers and do all the things that they know could sort of help them, you know, the social pushback of having fewer children, having children later, not staying home and say, you know, not doing all these sort of gender responsibilities, that also has another cost. And so the social expectations that we have surrounding gender and the gender pay gap, it sort of goes one in, you know, it goes hand in hand.
Yeah, excellent. A really important perspective. Thank you. Senator Escamilla, you are absolutely looked to as a leader in this issue. Can you help us kind of think about policy intervention? So what do we do? And this is not a new problem, of course, and it's probably a problem that's getting worse. What do we do?
So as a Latina woman, I'm depressed now. Thank you for someone that's been in the workplace for 20 plus years, which for you guys is very old. I don't think so. Graduated from the University of Utah. I think I can say I've faced that gap, and it's real. So I'll start there because, you know, I love these women that are full of numbers and data. And then there's the reality, right? And there's nothing worse than you learning that your coworker that probably does less than you do is making more money than you do. And that has happened to me before. So as a state senator, so that's even more funny. Which goes back to what you were explaining. It's like you maybe accomplish all these things and you still are facing this institutionalization of disparity. And that's the reality. And I want to have the conversation because it's uncomfortable for some people. And I've learned there's a lot of allies in the male side, which obviously many of you being here is because you guys care. This is a topic that matters. You probably have a mom. Of course, you have a mom. You may have a partner, a spouse, a wife, and you may have daughters. And this is real. It's happening. I have four daughters, and it matters to me. Because I'm thinking, it's 20 years from now, we're going to start having this conversation. I mean, are they going to be sitting in this panel and saying the same thing? It's going to break my heart. So what do we do? So policy, I love this, how we started this conversation. These are brilliant women, have tons of respect for them, had a chance to be in panels with them before. And it's a never-ending conversation. It's probably not going to end in my lifetime, but it's okay. Because it's one step at a time. So one is, how comfortable do we get with leaders, with the lawmakers, coming from my perspective, right? So policymakers, to actually even talk about this. They don't want to talk about this. They're like, nope, there's not a problem. Or no, it's just people make choices, right? So this idea that they make a choice at one point in their career. Or it's not comparing apples to apples. And I'm telling you, that is, I hear that more than anything. It's like, how do you compare someone that decided to make a choice to spend time with their children, which is no one's questioning that, and they leave the workforce, and then they're coming back, and what happens to that, those 3-4 years that they were out of the workforce? And oh, hi, I just saw someone that was in our interns. And how do you close that gap? And is it fair for the male counterpart? So a great question, because I get that all the time. So one of the things we need to do in the state of Utah, and I don't think we've done enough, aside of all these studies and now learning that there's even a new project of studies, my role has been in the last 4 years. I've been there 11 years in the legislature, guys. This is, and it's okay. We're going to keep on fighting this. It's having data to start in the public sector. Because this is a very broad, large issue. I mean, you can have, look at them. They've dedicated their careers, and there's more people here that this is what they do. Okay, we as legislators, we're generalists. We're reviewing 11,000 bills, you know, 1,100 bills. It feels like 1,000, but 1,100 bills, a session, a budget. And have as a part-time legislature, plus have our own full-time jobs on the side. So this is a very, the complexity behind this has made it challenging to have concrete policies that are data-driven. And I personally have struggled as someone that came from, with an MPA from the University of Utah to say, oh, this is a policy that we can implement and we'll move forward. And everyone's like, well, that may work in New York. That may work in Iceland, you know, different countries. How do we then make a Utah solution? And I love this because that's how my colleagues talk. Woo, we're all about Utah solutions. Okay, so this is what I propose. And not successfully yet, but we'll get there. Because I started by saying, can we have a study of the public sector and whether there is a gender gap in terms of wages? I was very focused into that. And what I learned is to resonate this with my colleagues, I needed to talk their language and a little bit more that makes sense to them. So We put together this great team with members of the economics department, and we have one of them here, and you know, two other incredibly intelligent people that could explain this to me in, you know, not a PhD level, because I don't have that. I just have a master's degree level. And then go back to the legislature and try to explain this to my colleagues with all their different backgrounds, right? They all have different reasons why they care about this. Many people do care, by the way. They're concerned. One is, how do we look? We look terrible. I mean, we keep on ranking the worst in this, in the country, right? It's like, ugh. So worse than per pupil spending and worse than gender wage gap. So what we started is saying, look, maybe the conversation needs to be more comprehensive about the public sector, our hiring, promotion, and retention practices. And in order to get that data, we need to start breaking that data, and breaking it in gender is critical. So we put together, in a way, this bill, which is not public, so don't panic, I'll explain why. Because what I learned is that this is very hard. I mean, it has to be very specific. It has to be, in order to get this data to be meaningful and analyze it in a way that makes sense, so we can then use it, because that's the key. When my colleagues were coming back and saying, so what if we get this report that says we're the worst in the world? I mean, then what, right? How do we change this? So what I came back to the team that we're working with in the economics department is saying, how do we then frame all of this that we're going to get in information in actually doable, measurable outcomes? So the study that I'm working on it, guys, is that we will have this very comprehensive analysis that will include a cross-state comparison. Let's learn what other states are doing. We're not the only ones facing this issue, obviously, as explained. How do we then really focus on the internal labor market analysis? I mean, here in Utah, because it is unique, as explained, right? I mean, we're not the same like our neighboring states. And occupational segregation study, and that has to do with those where maybe based on your gender, you tend to go to certain type of professions or industries. And then that segregation index. And then how do we then use state agencies as case studies, right? So how many, do you guys know how many state agencies are in state government? Anyone? 28. That's a lot of state agencies. All of them are different, right? I mean, you can't compare public safety, which oversees a highway patrol with 500 troopers, which most of them are men, compared to maybe Department of Human Services that deals with all social services, right? People with disabilities, DCFS, Child Protection Services. That's 80% women. So, I mean, how do we then have this and how do we have these conversations? How do we do case studies? So this proposal, it's called the Public Sector Compensation Study, was this very broader piece and then very definite, not solutions, because as solutions and as good researchers will say, that's not our job to bring solutions. We just bring the information to you guys. Which for some of my colleagues, like, that's so frustrating because I want to know what to do. But then with the best practices really helping us get there. So let me tell you what happened. I don't know if you heard on the news, but we had a little bit of a crisis with the budget. Things went south really bad. And we didn't have a budget until the last day of the session, which usually doesn't happen. I've been there doing this for many years and before that as working for the state, and I've never seen that happen before. So it put us in a really unique place, because what I was very concerned, why I didn't put this as a bill, is to have 103 other people, meaning my colleagues in the state legislature, that have no clue and haven't been through this, you know, exercise of understanding the complexity, putting or adding or removing stuff from the study. That would have been terrifying. So now my approach is doing this as a study and as part of what legislative management or executive appropriations, which is leadership in the legislature, saying, let's do this. This is what the recommendation from, you know, researchers and professionals from the University of Utah, which is our number one research institution in the state, can help us guide us through this process. So that's where I am, and that's where I think we can then move forward with policy. It's challenging. This is not an easy conversation to have, but it's not about blame anymore. It's really about focusing on moving forward, because people are suffering, and at the end, the entire economy suffers. I mean, this is, it's not like, oh, well, it's just the women of color in the corner that are going to be suffering. It's really everyone. It has to do with our tax. I mean, you talk about taxes. Isn't that like the biggest conversation now for us is tax reform? Well, if we want to have a good tax base, then they have to have those wages make sense. And anyway, so I'm excited for the opportunity. I'm not letting this go. This is my fourth year working on this, and we will continue working on this.
Excellent. Thank you, Senator.
That's Senator Luz Escamilla of the Utah Legislature. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. If you're just joining us, today on the program, we are airing a panel discussion on the gender wage gap, what it is, why it happens, and how to address it. Here is moderator Juliette Tennert.
Professor Barrick, do you want to kind of bring us back, maybe any specific highlights you'd like to point to or additional research you'd like to point to?
Yes.
Whatever you'd like to say.
I sort of want to, I guess, emphasize on the consequences of the gender wage gap a little bit more. So again, going to numbers, basically employed women in our state, that is part-time or full-time employed women in our state, are working almost 35 hours per week. They're working 33 hours. They're almost hitting that full-time mark. And so even if they are sort of expected generally to be devoting themselves full-time to motherhood, and they are out there in the labor force, yet they are not getting the returns that sort of a perhaps a more full-time sort of a career with a, in a higher occupation, higher-paying occupation would reward them. So they're in a way shortchanged. I mean, it's an unfairness issue here. They're expected to be full-time mothers, but the reality is they are almost full-time in the labor force. So that I want to point out. The other thing is 60% of Utah women and 60% of mothers with children under six are in the labor force. That may be perhaps, again, counter to the expectations of this sort of, oh, mothers with their children at home and, you know, full-time devotion to that. Maybe that's possible on a sort of very high income level families, but it's not the reality, at least in an average sense. So I wanted to point that out. Now, in terms of these you know, behavior changes that Claudia Geist talked about, yes, I mean, I identified those three variables, education, occupational choice, and disparate treatment as policy variables. And I think, I think all of that will probably segue into our, you know, what to do discussion. And so obviously employers have to take on some of those responsibilities, but not necessarily voluntarily, because, you know, it doesn't happen when you say, oh, let's all be good citizens and kind of look at our pay gap situation in our firms. And in fact, there's precedent, for example, if I can segue into that, there's precedent in terms of, in many countries, but also under the last few months of the Obama administration, there was an executive order requiring companies that employ 100 or more workers to publish their, or provide the government the earnings by gender and race and ethnicity to the Department of Labor. And they were already providing the statistics on, you know, their race and gender composition. So why not provide their salary information average for the groups as well? But this was overturned soon enough, within a year, as by another executive order. Now, the issue of transparency, pay transparency, as it is called, is important because it puts companies on the spot. Now that they have published their information, how much they're paying, workers get to know, regulators get to know, and companies maybe are shamed a little bit, and they will move to take action. Unless there's pay transparency, there's no way we can know if there's disparities within an organization. So that's a policy that I would speak in favor of. But there are sort of related, you know, employer-level things, that policies that we could be undertaking. But again, and there's a lot of sort of state-level traction where, for example, states prohibit pay secrecy. States prohibit inquiring about past salaries of prospective hires. Now, these are all ways in which existing discriminatory pay structures can kind of perpetuate themselves. So it's sort of a drawing, putting in a wedge to such sort of perpetuating patterns. And now all of this could be, of course, taken care of with one law called Paycheck Fairness Act, which has been languishing in Congress for the past several years. So that could be at the federal level. Now, all of these transparency, pay secrecy, prohibiting asking about past salaries could be taken care of by such an act, and maybe that will come to pass in this particular session. But so that's one area. And if I can quickly just at least highlight two others. One is, of course, paid family leave is another important policy initiative that we should be considering. And of course, again, at the state level, there's quite a bit of traction in that area. States are passing paid family leave policies, funding them as insurance schemes that basically payroll taxes pay for supporting a paid family leave, to enable a sort of a wage replacement scheme. So in other words, when you're going to take time off to care for a sick parent or you're having a newborn, then your salary is partially replaced during that pioneer period. And so that obviously, you know, paid subsidies for childcare, paid subsidies for paid elderly care. So those are all part of the same issue of the objective is to make sure families do not bear the cost, or at least they share the cost of having children and caring for family members. So I think I'll stop there.
That's great. Excellent. Thank you. I appreciate that. Professor Chatai?
Yeah. Okay, great. So I want to add a couple more things. Working internationally, one works in very different countries. Some of these countries have very difficult social norms, so to speak, to address. But nonetheless, we all have to try to see different ways of moving forward. Because at the rate that wage gaps are closing, there are many different estimates of this, but it's going to take like 70 years, 80 years, 100 and something years. We'll all be dead. And we don't want to this to be our legacy for the next generation. And the other thing is that the loss that is made at the for individual workers when we make these calculations are actually colossal over the whole lifetime. So this can range from, estimates range from $400,000 to $800,000. So hundreds of thousands of dollars is the loss that we are talking about. And actually the gaps are larger the higher the level of education. So we really need to do our best. And in my case, I have worked both in terms of what are public policies that need to be formulated, including policies at the macroeconomic level, because a lot of times people are thinking of this as a microeconomic issue, but as I said, it has macroeconomic consequences, and also fiscal policy has to be a part of the policymaking thing. So I want to make one point on that fiscal policy and connect these efforts to reduce gender gaps or to eliminate them, but also to eliminate poverty, because those two things are actually twin, should be twin targets of economic and social policy. We are talking a lot these days about the new Green Deal, or the Green New Deal, or the new Green Deal. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the discussion is in terms of course, creating some jobs by the public sector, and also jobs that are ecologically beneficial, and also to sort of try to arrest climate change and so on and so forth. So a lot of times what governments do, and in the United States at state level, is that they build physical infrastructure, because physical infrastructure is what we call a public good. Mm-hmm. Right, so we pay for those out of our taxes. But a social infrastructure of care is also a public good. And if we don't think about it as a public good, then we're going to have women pay for this. And in fact, when we look at empirical data, of course, one of the findings that we have in research is that there is something called a motherhood pay penalty. Women get penalized as they become mothers. And in the case of men, they actually get a premium. So this is a fatherhood pay premium. As men become fathers, they actually get a premium compared to men who don't have children, whereas for women, it's just the opposite. So it's women who pay economically for this social infrastructure of care that we should be putting into place, and therefore we should be putting our tax dollars. But also, this has the consequence. So when you build a social infrastructure of care, because of occupational segregation that exists currently in the care economy, one would be creating jobs disproportionately for women, given the occupational segregation patterns now. I'm not saying that we should also eliminate occupational segregation patterns, but you tend to create more jobs for women. And this pushes up the wages. So there is a kind of a use of a public and market mechanisms to close the wages again. Because if you're just engaging in investment in physical infrastructure, then you're creating jobs disproportionately, men's jobs, and that overall creates the gap. The second thing I will talk about, and I'm really sorry, but I want to mention this. I believe, of course, in public policy bills. Of course I do. And also the public sector is kinder to women. Gender gaps in the public sector, always this is kind of internationally, are lower compared to the private sector. So, but it's everybody has to do, put their money where their mouth is. And that includes the corporations and the private sector. But no one single policy action is going to be sufficient by itself. So one of the things that I have worked on in the context of working for the United Nations is an implementation guide for private companies. These are large private companies specifically for Turkey, for the Turkish economy. And Turkey is not... half the population is very conservative. The other half is very not conservative. So we have a population divided, if you will, ideologically smack in the middle. Turkey happens to be one of the countries that has the largest number of companies that are signatories to something called the Global Compact on Women's Empowerment Principles. And you can Google this, WEPS, Women Empowerment Principles. This is an initiative of the United Nations. And large companies signed to them, and I think that Turkey may have the largest number of companies who made a pledge to uphold gender equality in their workplace. And we worked on an implementation guide. And this is not just about gender gaps in pay. The implementation guide is all generally about how do you try to bring about gender equality in your own firm. And this was done in a kind of a participatory way, with the participation of us and people who are experts, academics and UN advisors, but also participation from the firms themselves to come up with good practices and to also sort of work out a plan to see what, and this included these plans, or also include the publication of data and them monitoring themselves. Yes, we must have laws about transparency and so on, but until thy kingdom come, we can also encourage all parties to undertake it. Because some companies, why would they do that? Because companies, some CEOs, not all CEOs, recognize that this is an issue for them of competitiveness, being able to attract workers with talent who might otherwise get excluded. They realize that it has to do, it can connect to their bottom line, not just in terms of sort of ethical behavior, but some of them also recognize that it actually connects to their bottom line because they can attract talented workers, and this is the reason why they want to also get rid of sort of gender equality quality in there. And there are many practices that we collected. This is online. I can give you the reference, but this is also one of the things that people, it's not sufficient by itself, but I think we have to move forward in all directions.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Professor. Thank you. So clearly an hour for this topic is just not enough time. I think that we need a symposium to discuss this. An hour is not enough time. So recognizing the fact that we just an hour is not enough time, Professor Geist, Senator Escamilla, can you wrap this up for us, kind of take us home just so we can leave a few minutes for questions from the audience, but please wrap us up.
Okay, so I'll just make two points real quick that just complement. You know, I'm all for regulation. Yeah. One of the things which may be uncharacteristic from me is an individual sort of appeal for people, especially for women who are in relationships with men, is to ask for equality at home, to ask for equal sharing, to ask for co-parenting and not just helping. Because one of the things is that there's an imbalance that, you know, many women are brought up to like be satisfied with less, and I just want people to feel empowered or entitled, depending on where you're coming from, but demand equality, not just in the workplace, also in the workplace, but also at home. The other part, and this is a perfect segue, is that there's very well established a motherhood wage gap. And like very recently, there is much more policies that take reproductive autonomy away from people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like parenthood can be a wonderful thing, especially if that's something that you want. But access to contraception, access to abortion, you know, is an important part of the puzzle that where sort of better childcare services, that is not enough. So to really have an all-encompassing set of structural circumstances that enable us to close the wage gap, we need to give people more bodily autonomy, and that includes access to, you know, the full spectrum of reproductive health services.
Thank you. That was cool. Thank you. Perfect. Thank you. All right.
Thank you. I want to end maybe with, I started a conversation last year in terms of policy from a holistic approach of, you know, to industries and businesses beyond the public sector study, because this is very specific to Utah state government, but having the conversation about what would it take to have a holistic approach to, as an employer, as an industry, to my employees, or, you know, people that are going to provide success to my company or my industry, and talking about this whole comprehensive approach, both for men and women. And I think that those are the type of policies that are in an incremental way. So this is not gonna be the huge reform that maybe we're all waiting and have this massive change in policy. This is gonna take multiple legislation. Some of them are gonna fail, so just get ready. We're gonna have to come back and change them. I mean, this happens all the time, and I've seen them as it's incremental steps. There's not a silver bullet solution. And that's the challenge of all of this, because you all are facing it right now. We're all facing it. It's like real for everyone. So my holistic approach is this. It has a little bit to do to what the doctor was explaining, is how do we start the conversation from the person, and what would it take for me as a person to succeed in the workplace? Because, you know, if we talk about economic development and the environment and workplace, and this Utah is a number one place for businesses and number one place for workers, then okay, prove it. So what it will take is having these businesses talk about, okay, how do I have my employees coming here and being successful when they're here so they can go back home and be happy? And what does that mean? It means, well, healthcare, of course, so it can be healthy, which is the problem, right? We don't have that. And then what it will take when it comes to childcare. Mm-hmm. So the biggest problem, the most unsafe time for children in school is between 3 to 6 p.m. That's when we have more gang-related activity, more teenage pregnancy issues, more accidents of children, because they're not after school. We don't have an after-school program issue in the state. So I've passed legislation at least to standardize quality after-school program for the first time in 2013. There was never even a reference in our statute. Mm-hmm. So those are massive issues of talking about someone being fully integrated in the workplace and having all the potential of that person and be successful. So I'm having conversations about childcare. I mean, if I'm telling you that training your employee and spending, I mean, between training them, hiring them, putting them in your workplace, averaging $60,000 a year, just give or take, every time you lose that person, you have to do this again. What if I tell you just give me $30,000 for childcare, put it in your, close to your location of your building, your business, and you're going to have a happy employee? Wouldn't that be a great ROI? I'm spending half of, I mean, we're talking about those numbers, and those are the type of conversations I think we need to move in a holistic, comprehensive approach. It can't be just one thing and think that it's going to solve everything. It's going to be holistic, and it's going to take many, many conversations and really talking about return on investment. I know I work for a bank, and I understand what it means for a business to have this conversation. This is not, I mean, this is beyond doing it because it's the right thing to do. It's because it makes sense from your business model, and you will have the ROI that you need. And I think that's the way to also get some allies that maybe have not been at the table. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you. So we're pushing right up against the hour. Do we have time for one question?
Does anybody have one?
We can do
question?
One. Yeah. Okay. Excellent. Just I saw your hand go up first right here. So.
So I just wanted to quickly, briefly thank everybody so much for being at the panel today. You guys are all fascinating and amazing, strong women who are doing great things for my generation and others. But I wanted to pose this last question to the entire panel. As students and as young women trying to make changes in this world, what is something that we can do while we're not in a true career path yet, while we're still maybe in part-time jobs trying to figure things out? Like, what is left for us to do to make change?
Vote.
I would say just inform yourself of the issues. First of all, if there are young women here, please consider studying economics and becoming economists.
Yes.
Contributing to knowledge and also doing advocacy. But when I say please become economists, because women are very underrepresented in economics, so we really need you and your brains and your heart and spirit, but also, of course, doing advocacy around all of these issues.
Find the thing that you're passionate about and then stick with it, and don't let other people tell you that they know so much better, because it's your life.
You need to vote. I mean, we really need to start changing who are the people making the decisions, because then the conversation is easier, and it's changing to where we are, and it's not reflecting. If you go to the Capitol or to other places, I don't think it's reflecting that communities. So let's get engaged, and voting and participating is important.
Thank you. Professor Barrett, last word from Professor Barrett. She's everything that everyone just said, right? Excellent. Thank you very much.
Please join me in thanking our panelists.
If you'd like to hear the full discussion or listen to other Hinckley forums, you can find them on our website, kcpw.org. This forum was co-sponsored by the Women's Resource Center and the Women's Enrollment Initiative. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your host and producer of this program. As always, thanks for listening.